Today in Studio 360, Cassandra Wilson has redefined what it means to be a jazz singer. She combines material from country and blues and folk and rock. Now she's going back to one of the classic jazz vocalists, Billie Holiday.
Good morning, honey.
Like Billie Holiday, Cassandra Wilson has a voice that is instantly recognizable. And one reason is because it's so deep.
I'm actually a baritone. You can't call me a baritone because I'm a woman.
My conversation with Cassandra Wilson later this hour. And also, we're going to try to make Monday your favorite day of the week.
Monday, Monday.
Don't believe that's possible? Just wait until we reveal the results of our Design for Joy project. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But first,
the last line of my original act was, "This business, it's all about casting couches, so I just want you to know my name's Joan Rivers, and I put out."
The casting couch is one of the enduring cliches and punchlines in showbiz. But an extensively reported article in the New York Times the other day suggested it's no joke at all in what they call the legitimate theater. The Times quoted lots of playwrights and actors who describe being sexually harassed or abused by producers, directors, stars, and finding themselves without much recourse. Most of those victims were women, but not all. Here with me now to talk about the problem is Julia Jordan, a playwright who is leading an effort to change the culture of sexual harassment and sexual expectation in the theater. Julia Jordan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So, is sexual harassment especially common in theater compared to other areas of the entertainment industry?
You know, it's everywhere. It's in colleges. It's everywhere. It's just not any less in the theater. And I think because of the nature of theater, we're constantly taking off our clothes and kissing each other and acting out love scenes and acting out violence. It's just a place in which the lines are blurry. They
right.
already are blurry.
So. Right. And you know, when you come together to make a play or make a movie, but to make a play, it's this weird, temporary, intense bonding moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where people often do engage in affairs of various kind,
mm-hmm.
consensual affairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of the culture in a certain way.
Definitely. I mean, it's full of young people, and a lot of us put off marriage and super monogamous relationships because we're constantly moving around. So all those things feed into it. But I think even larger point is that because these are, 8-week stints if you get a job and then you're unemployed for a while until you get the next one, it's the scarcity that prevents people from speaking up and laying down boundaries.
That seems important because it's not like you have a job where the person is probably not going to fire you, and you can go to their boss and say, "Hey, this dude is demanding X, Y, and Z of me."
Yeah, you really don't have any job security. We all know each other. We all socialize. And, word gets around.
And just so we're clear, we're not talking about unwelcome compliments or sexist microaggression. We're talking at least a lot about people saying, "Perform this sexual act for me if you want this job."
Well, it's a lot of things. But yes, I hope it isn't looked at as the unwelcome comment thing. But there's so much gray area between that and something that's criminal that means somebody needs to go to jail. What I think what we're asking Equity to do is specifically about making a place where we can say, "I think this is wrong. This happened to me," and have somewhere to go where you at least get some guidance, where there are some rules, where there is someone who has some kind of authority to step in and make things right.
Actors Equity is the main union, the union for stage actors. And so that's the most important place you think you can go to try to get some formal protocols and rules and recourse?
I should make it clear, most of these, the people who have been talking have been actors because I think they're in a particular position. But I'm a writer. And then I've gotten countless emails and phone calls from people who are crew members and people who are stage managers. I mean, it really doesn't limit itself to the actors. There's also the problem that Equity is only responsible, or the unions are only responsible for what happens within a show.
Right.
In theater. But if something happens at the bar and you have to step on stage with that person, act out a love scene the very next day, and you don't feel safe, I think that needs to be addressed, because that's a real problem.
One of the things I wondered, because I've lived in New York a while, I know a lot of people in the theater, I've been in and around it, because the theater world has such a kind of old school, retro romantic view of itself, does that enable and encourage this kind of thing? Oh, we're just like the dames and the guys in the 40s, and they smoked and drank and did whatever. Is that part of it, do you think?
You know, maybe. I love that part of it, you know? And I've written plays that have required nudity. And so I don't want to shut that down. I just want to have it just, you know, I just think it's if something happened to you, which, I mean, things have happened to me. I would just like to know who to call.
So what has happened to you of this kind?
Well, this was like, you know, gosh, 20-something years ago. But when I was young, and I think it usually does happen to people who are young or lower on the totem pole. When I was young, I was a playwriting student at Juilliard, and I was asked by a prominent director if I would like to be his assistant. And I had never seen a professional production before. I had gone to acting school, but I had never actually been in a show. I just started writing. So then he asked me out, and then I explained that I had a boyfriend and I wasn't up for that. I was promptly replaced. Hmm. It was that simple, you know? And do I think that he should go to jail for that? Absolutely not. But those things just shouldn't happen. If something like that happens, I didn't even think at the time that I should tell anyone.
Julia Jordan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julia Jordan is a playwright and vice president of the Lily Awards Foundation, which recognizes women in the theater. So what do you think? Does the theater need more formal and stricter sexual harassment policies? And will they make a difference? Tell us what you think at studio360.org. We've gotten accustomed to thinking that design with a capital D can make pretty much anything better. Cool gadgets and digital apps, hospitals, trains, supermarkets, whatever. But can good design take unpleasant places and experiences and make them joyful? Last month, we asked you for suggestions of things that could use a joy makeover. We got a lot of good ideas, from the DMV to taxes to the morning commute. We handed all of your suggestions over to the design firm IDEO, and they picked an ambitious challenge to bring joy to Mondays. Everybody knows that Monday's the worst, so we were really eager to see what a big, world-class design firm could possibly do to make it joyful. We sent Studio 360's Julia Lowry Henderson to see what they came up with, and she started early.
This is how I woke up this morning.
Good morning. So that's it's a laughing alarm clock. It's actually really nice to wake up to that. I mean, it's still 7 o'clock in the morning, but I like that.
I got that alarm clock from a design team at IDEO. They've spent the last few weeks dreaming up ways to make Mondays more joyful. That's one way. And I went to their offices to see the rest of their plans.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm good.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Yeah. Welcome.
Everything about IDEO's offices when I showed up was joyful.
Thanks for the balloons and the elevator.
Yay. They really went all out.
I'm Ingrid, a design director here at IDEO New York.
I'm Corinne. I'm a designer here at IDEO.
Their desks are in this little space at the back of the office. On one side, there is a wall covered top to bottom in pictures, things from magazines or stuff they found on the web. And not surprisingly, they are color-coded.
We know that yellow is joyful, so we created a whole section that's just yellow imagery. You can see we have a piece of bubble wrap up there because we know that people love popping bubble wrap. It comes in the studio, and we're kind of like little pack rats. Anything that's joyful that comes in the studio, we take and we put up on the wall for inspiration.
And along another wall are a bunch of big white boards covered in sketches. These are the ideas that didn't make the final cut, like Monday toilet paper or a life-size Candy Crush game in an elevator.
We did spend some time thinking about the elevator, and one of the concepts that is definitely a no-go is the trampoline elevator.
If you need me to explain to you why a trampoline elevator is a bad idea, I'd be more than happy to. But before they even tackled their ideas, the first thing they thought about is why we hate Mondays so much, which seems obvious, but still.
I'm standing here looking at a board that has a bunch of Post-its with the bad things about Mondays and a bunch of Post-its with the great things about Fridays and Saturdays.
Meetings came up a lot and feeling rushed, so we thought a lot about what it means to start the day on Monday and starting off on the right foot.
I love the weekend hangover. I mean, like, I have no idea what that's about, but I appreciate that that came up.
Interestingly, health came up a lot, too. Like, what did it mean if you felt like you got a proper night's sleep, again, didn't feel rushed, had eaten well, not drank?
So the designers started reaching out to people who they thought would have unique insight into being happy.
For example, someone who teaches laughter yoga, or the founder of an organization that trains therapy dogs.
Am I going to get a puppy?
No comment. No.
For the record, I did not get a puppy.
So we're going to show you three ideas, and we've grouped them together under this overarching idea we're calling From Monday to Mon-yay. And really, this is about finding ways to bring small moments of joy into everyone's Monday.
The first prototype was that laughing alarm clock. I used it on my phone, but they're actually working on building a real alarm clock that rocks while it giggles and that you can tickle to make it laugh harder. The IDEO team really likes physical objects that heighten the sense of play, and they put one in every concept. Their second concept is called Sincerely.
What we found on Sunday night is that Sunday, you're in kind of a scarcity mindset, right? You're just thinking about what you don't have, which is the time that's running out of your weekend, the things you didn't get to do, the people you didn't get to see. And this is an opportunity to actually refocus you on the opposite, on abundance, on what you have a lot of. And we know that, you know, there's tons of research about gratitude and how gratitude actually helps you refocus on what you have and can increase your happiness.
You open up an app and record a message thanking someone for something. The person who gets your message receives it on a little thing that looks like a can painted white, kind of like the old childhood cans on a string trick. The inside of the can is a speaker, and on the top of the can is a piece of thin, flexible tubing. When you get a message, the tubing waves around like a dog's tail. And when I picked it up, they had a surprise for me.
Hey, Jules, it's Jenny. Thank you for being such a ray of sunshine on Mondays, and really...
It was a message from one of my fellow producers.
Thank you for letting me know that you have my back. I've got yours, too.
Oh, my God. Jenny Lawton is the sweetest person ever. I mean, the only thing that would make that more perfect is if, like, a little golden retriever ran up to me with it.
So the laughing alarm clock brought me joy, and the thank you message brought me joy. Could they go 3 for 3?
So this last one we're calling, it's a two-parter, pop-up and no to fly.
Okay, everyone knows one of the worst parts of Monday is that on the weekend you have all this freedom. And then on Monday you have all these things to do and places to be and deadlines to meet.
And so what we did was to create a calendar app that tried to kind of delineate time but also surface opportunities for joy in your day.
So on this calendar you can only see one day, today. Instead of a grid that makes you feel boxed in, it's a clean white screen with your appointments in these big colored bubbles of varying size. When you tap your appointment, it tells you something potentially joyful about it.
Here you have a dinner date, but you find out that a few blocks away there's a joyful detour to the best vista of the Manhattan Bridge, for instance. So you can click on that and it'll tell you how to get there and also a glimpse of what you might see. And then you can also go in to understand a little bit of the science as to why it matters and how that's meaningful in terms of understanding its impact for joy.
Obviously, they can't come up with something joyful about every single appointment, but my favorite part of the app is that at the end of the day, you get to pop the bubbles. The companion piece to the calendar is an object called Notify. It looks kind of like a large round paperweight.
What Notify will do is whenever you have a meeting, it will send up one perfect soap bubble.
Maybe you're thinking, oh, a giant bubble is going to tell me when I have a meeting. That is so not useful.
There are lots of things we could do to make Monday better or Monday calmer or Monday easier, but that's actually not what we were asked to do. What we were asked to do was make Monday more joyful, and that's what we've designed to.
And the great part is, you can use all these inventions on any day of the week. For Studio 360, I'm Julia Lowry Henderson.
You can see photos of their inventions in action at studio360.org. You can also download and use their Giggle alarm tone and learn how to send that surprise electronic thank you. Everything you need to imbue Monday or any day with a little more joy. Thanks to Ingrid Fattel and all the designers at IDEO for doing their best to remove Monday from the synonyms for bummer. Coming up, the jazz singer Cassandra Wilson pays tribute to the extraordinary sound of Billie Holiday.
You have to create a singular voice. You can't imitate anyone. Whatever it is that's happening in your life, that goes into the voice, and it becomes your instrument.
Cassandra Wilson, later this hour in Studio 360, from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Hush now.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. If I told you about a programmer who came up with an algorithm that would make new paintings in the style of great artists, you might get mad. But hold on, because Jen Schiffer is not trying to replace any human painters. Ethan Scheel has our story.
Try and picture a composition by the artist Pete Mondrian. Composition number 10, for example. A grid of black lines on canvas and blocks of primary colors at the edges. It's hard to do the painting justice with words, but Jen Schiffer's description of it is pretty effective.
It looks like sort of like windows within windows. Think of like a two-dimensional white background, stained glass, but just paint.
Jen isn't an artist, not most of the time. She's a software engineer. In her day job, she builds websites, and in her off time, she also builds websites. One of those is VART, V-A-R-T dot Institute.
VART is actually var space t colon, and it is a syntax for creating a variable, and the variable is the letter t. So A-R-T, art, the v is just from var to make the variable. But var t is too hard to say for me, so I just call it VART. And then, like, people laugh because it rhymes with fart, and I think that's hilarious because I'm 9 years old.
Jen's mission statement for VART is pretty clear. At the top of the VART homepage, it says, quote, I love art and code. Jen's relatively new to mixing them. Last September, she took this trip to Chicago.
I walked around and I spent all my free time there looking at the public art and going to the Art Institute.
She was in town for a conference on the programming language JavaScript. She was giving a presentation on using HTML tables to display statistics.
And I was like, I'm going to make art using tables. I wonder who else has done that. And then I remember Pete Mondrian, and I was like, I'm going to try to recreate his work using tables and JavaScript. And that day at that conference is when I started writing my first VART post.
Her Mondrian project went up a week later. It's a little program that creates variations on composition number 10.
The Mondrian piece was generative. Every time you refresh it, there was a randomized algorithm that would create these tables nested and then also add the primary colors.
The code is adjustable.
$ parentheses canvas, array 0, index 0.
You can tweak it to generate a Mondrian made of many smaller grids or a few larger ones. If you want to, you can make the program create an orange and chartreuse Mondrian, which is kind of beautiful in a scary way.
Canvas.getContext in parentheses 2D.
The first time Jen tried to make art by writing a program was a couple years ago, when she was working at a university.
some of the professors there were just like, why? It's like, if you're not making something that the government is interested in, then it's like, why is it worth it? You're wasting your time. And I felt this like negative pressure to do that, but I didn't want to. I also wanted to do creative stuff and have fun, but I felt like it made me less of a web developer.
When she first posted her Mondrian generator, somebody put it up on Hacker News. That's a site where people talk about new software, and the comments don't tend to be constructive.
I looked, and I saw over a dozen comments, and I was like, uh-oh, like, here's where they're going to say that this is, like, crap. But actually, it was mostly people showing stuff that they've created based on Mondrian's work in different languages. Somebody actually emailed me an 8-bit emulator that they had written, and Mondrian was the example to show it off. And they wrote it in an assembly language that they created themselves, which is, like, really awesome.
A lot of the projects were like Jen's. Small personal pieces done because some programmer liked art or was bored or both.
The only negative-ish feedback I got was like, this is really easy. This is so easy. And it's like, well, I didn't say Vart learning art using JavaScript, only hard examples because I'm super hardcore rockstar JavaScript developer. Like, that's not what the subtitle is.
And it was pretty easy. She did it in a week. These projects aren't about showing off incredible programming skills. They're about being creative in a medium that most people don't acknowledge as creative. But Jen does keep making it harder for herself. She had to figure out how to create variations on Magritte, the surrealist. And then there's her project on Mary Cassatt. Cassatt is an impressionist whose work is mostly portraiture, with colors that blend and overlap. You might wonder how Jen would code that, but the trick is that she didn't. Instead, she focused on Cassatt's messy sketches. She made a tool that lets you create rough outlines of pre-existing images. It's unusual and kind of entrancing to play with.
My paintings, my so-called paintings of like Mondrian and Magritte, don't look exactly like their paintings. I don't want to perfectly recreate someone else's work because that can't be done. But I feel like all the stuff that I create isn't meant to duplicate their work. It's just sort of my interpretation and I add my own things to it.
What Jen's doing is a lot like what an art student does sketching at a museum. Only Jen doesn't draw. She writes JavaScript.
I want to be a programmer. I don't want to leave tech, but I also want to be an artist and write and like create cool stuff. And I want to be able to do that without feeling like I'm wasting my time on either or thing. And Vart is, I need something to light a fire under my butt to get me to learn more about art. If writing code helps me do that, then that's great.
For Studio 360, I'm Ethan Scheel.
You can see some examples of Jen Schiffer's work at studio360.org, and you can try out her program to generate your own faux Mondrian. Time magazine has called Cassandra Wilson America's best singer. She is, without a doubt, the most important jazz singer of her generation. When you put on one of her records, you won't hear familiar standards accompanied by a typical combo. Instead, you'll hear singular interpretations of everything from folk songs to U2 over non-standard, unfamiliar arrangements. Even her scatting is completely her own. Since the 1980s, Cassandra Wilson has been pushing the boundaries of what a jazz singer can be and do. So it's only right that her new album, Coming Forth by Day, is a tribute to the great female jazz and blues singer of the last century, Billie Holiday.
Good morning, heartache. You ugly me sight. Good morning, heartache. Thought we'd said goodbye that night. I turned and tossed. It seemed you had gone.
And she joins me now. Cassandra Wilson, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So this record is coming out on her centennial. She would have been 100 this year. So that's just one more reason why it feels right for you to be doing this now?
You know, I'm in that lineage of singers. I consider myself to be in that lineage. Abby Lincoln was a great mentor for me, and Billie Holiday, of course, was her mentor.
Yeah.
So it made sense. Bruce Lundvall was the one who first suggested it. He, you know, he was at Blue Note.
The great jazz label in America.
So he said, listen, you know, she's got a centennial coming up. You should do a tribute to her. And, it made a lot of sense to me then, and I just started to think about it.
You strike me as, I mean, yes, definitely, obviously in this lineage through Abby Lincoln, but such a saner, better, happier person than she was.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's a different time that I live in.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a different time that I live in than Billy lived in. And they made a lot of sacrifices. You know, they went through hell.
Yeah.
Doing what they did, being women amongst men, being black women in America, being hunted.
Yep.
It was a difficult time. Now it's a little bit, I can be a kinder, gentler.
Yeah. And still alive 15 years after she was dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a blessing.
Reading about her, I'm struck by how insecure she was about her talent, that she didn't really understand all the fuss that was made about her originally. Was there a moment when you realized you had this singular voice and people wanted to hear it and that you were special?
I still wonder about it today. I'm just singing my life. And yeah. I think that's what Billy was doing, as did Abby. And the voice, of course, in our music, in our discipline, you have to create a singular voice. You can't imitate anyone.
Right.
So whatever it is that's happening in your life, that goes into the voice, and it becomes your instrument.
But with now that you've had for decades people saying, well, she's the greatest American singer. Cassandra Wilson, she's as good as it gets. Do you have to work to keep your head from getting too swollen, or do you just have the natural self-hate that most artists do?
I wouldn't call it self-hate. I just don't take myself too seriously.
Good.
You know, I like to have fun. You know, my life is the music. I'm blessed to be able to do this. So I try to enjoy every moment. And I don't read the reviews, whether they're good or bad. I just know that the work has to be done. And
well, there aren't many bad ones. As long as you don't read them, let me tell you, they're mostly good.
Thank you.
So this new record, Coming Forth by Day, is a tribute to Billie Holiday. But these are not just covers of famous Billie songs. I want to play one that you wrote. It's called Last Song for Lester.
I could not help but cry. It cut so deeply to say.
That's extra dreamy. The title refers to the saxophonist Lester Young.
Yes.
So tell the story there. Why on a record about Billie Holiday is there a song to Lester Young?
Well, while Billie Holiday was touring, she was in London. Lester Young passed away. And so she rushed home to attend the funeral.
And they had played, they had recorded together.
Well, they were very, very close. They were musical soulmates.
Yeah.
But when he starts in to love me, he is so fine alone.
I think they had some sort of falling out. Previous couple of years, hadn't spoken to each other or something like that. So when she heard about him passing away, she rushed home and attended the funeral and fully expected to sing for him. But she was not allowed to sing at the funeral. So this song was written for her to be able to do that.
So you're 60 years later, you're making up for that snub.
Yeah, we
good.
Are.
Good. You're a contralto, which is the lowest female register voice.
I'm actually a baritone.
Are you? Well, there you
but
go.
But you can't call me a baritone because I'm a woman.
Well, and my question exactly. To what extent does having that unusual register influence the type of music you can sing?
It really doesn't bother me. You know, I'll sing whatever I feel like singing. I'll just place it in a key that works for me.
But I'm thinking you're able to sing songs that, say, were written by four men that a lot of women could not do in the ways that they were intended, and you can pull them off.
I hadn't thought about that, but I do. You know, especially in the blues, I'm really attracted to the men's stories, not the women's stories. You know, I don't do victim.
Yes.
So I guess I'm attracted to the man out on the road, you know, doing his thing. I'm like into that story more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cliche about registers is that altos are always jealous of sopranos for getting the high notes that they can show off on. Do you ever feel that? Did you ever feel that?
No, because I'm always reaching for the low ones.
There you go.
I find that the low notes really astound audiences because it's coming from a woman.
Yep.
And if you just pick the right one in the right place, it can just really do something to them.
So you just take the particular gifts you have and show off with those.
I work with what I got.
As a kid in Jackson, Mississippi, in the 1960s, you were studying classical piano. Your father was teaching you. And you were, I read, loving the Monkees, which your first record was a Monkees album.
Da, 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 da. Yeah. I used to watch the show.
You and I both.
Did you watch it?
Yeah, sure, of course.
I loved it so much.
Because I was just a little too late. I was little. I mean, I was too late for the real 60s rock and roll, so the Monkees were my thing.
Yeah, the Monkees, exactly, for me as well.
And then, I read, in high school you started performing as a folky, essentially.
Yeah.
Talk about that. What was who were your mates and what did you sing?
Well, I started playing the guitar when I was 12. So I started to write music from the guitar. Because I thought...
As a 12-year-old?
Yeah, I felt that instrument. I learned it intuitively. I mean, I taught myself some chords, but I really had a different kind of relationship with that instrument than I did with the piano. And so around the...
A better one?
Oh, yeah, much better. I'm much closer to the guitar. And around about the time I was in high school, you know, Joni Mitchell was in, James Taylor, Richie Havens, Odetta, you know, that whole, what do you call it, 60s... ish type music.
Late folk.
Late folk.
Yeah, yeah.
I was fascinated by it. Yeah. And the songwriting thing, too, was fascinating to me as well.
Did you perform your own songs as well or just cover Odetta and Dylan?
I did a lot of covers. Yeah. I did a lot of covers, but I did write a few songs.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Do you still have them?
Ooh, they're on my father's reel-to-reel somewhere.
Really?
My father used to do reel-to-reels.
You can dig those out.
I got to look for them.
In 1993, you signed with Blue Note, which is the great jazz label, and put it on an album called Blue Light Till Dawn.
There's a crow flying, black and ragged tree to tree. It's black as that highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on something.
Speaking of Joni Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
That was Black Crow.
Perfect timing.
You also sang on that album Tupelo Honey, the Van Morrison tune. Were you fighting your way out of the expectation in one fell swoop that jazz singers could only do jazz standards?
Yes, I was always fighting that battle. My philosophy was that, you know, if you're going to be a jazz musician, you always got to use, you have to use the material that is happening in your time. And it doesn't make sense to just continue to regurgitate the material from a certain era.
Absolutely. And a couple of years later, you made a record called New Moon Daughter, which was a big hit, and you won a Grammy, and it included this song.
Take the last train to Clarksville, and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30, cause I made a reservation. Don't be slow. No, no, no. Oh, no, no, no.
So 28 years later, the Monkees at last. Shocking. Shocking.
Oh, wow. I did that one on a dare. Craig Street said, I dare you to come up with a treatment for this. And I said, let's do this.
Yeah.
And it was actually Boyz II Heart, who wrote some great songs. They really did. They wrote some really beautiful songs. And that's a song that's about the Vietnam War.
And I don't know if I'm ever coming home.
You know, that song is still in my repertoire.
Really?
And people love it.
I bet.
People love it.
I bet.
I still love to do it. Yeah. I never tire of doing that song.
Yeah. On that album, there is also a Hank Williams tune, a Neil Young song, and this U2 song.
Love is blindness, I don't want to see. Won't you wrap the night around me? Oh, my love. Love is blindness.
How do you pick the songs that you record?
Well, the songs pick me. I really have precious little to do with the process.
Really? Just things you fall in love with.
Things that I fall in love with and things that resonate. The story has to resonate, and I'll find a way to get to it. You know, musically, I'll always find a way to get to it. If it's, you know, especially if it's associated with a memory, a sense memory, an experience.
But what if a song resonates, you love it? Are there times when that happens and you just can't figure out a way that it works for you?
Yes, that has happened. You know, there's songs that I love, absolutely love.
Like?
We tried to do Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. Couldn't find a way into it.
Really?
No. Got to leave that one alone.
That kind of surprises me. What? Why?
Well, I don't know. I did do a treatment of it. Uh-huh. You know, I generally sketch the songs out on the guitar first. Fine tunings for them and everything. And there is a tuning, you know, and there is a copy of it somewhere.
Uh-huh.
You know, some rough copy uh-huh. of it. But it just didn't seem to pan out with the band.
Uh-huh. So when you did this, doing U2 and, you know, Van Morrison, did the Jazz Police cause a ruckus? Did that ruffle feathers when you recorded those kinds
of
songs?
Yeah, I saw him picture up in a few clubs. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, wanted.
Yeah.
No. In a way, they had to, you know, because some people who have very strong opinions about what jazz should sound
right.
like, what it should be,
right.
where it should go.
Yeah.
So naturally, yeah, there were some people who...
And you were provoked. I mean, you knew you were provoking, right?
That's my personality.
Yeah.
I like to just knock that chip off your shoulder.
Yeah. So here you are in the 1990s, pushing the boundaries of what a jazz singer can do. You're also working with Wynton Marsalis, who is, of course, the big jazz purist. He doesn't think of you as a heretic or a troublemaker?
Yes, he does. And I'm sure he throws darts at a picture of me in a closet in his house. But he's very kind to me. We're close. You know, when I see him, we tease each other. I like him a lot. I think he's a great person. And you know, everybody serves a purpose in this music.
Yeah.
We all can't be Wynton Marsalis.
Right.
And I'm sure he appreciates that.
I'm sure he does. Billie Holiday is obviously the great American jazz blues goddess. As you decided to do this tribute to her, did you feel that carried a different kind of responsibility and weight? Oh, my God, I'm at the altar of Billie Holiday now?
Yeah, I did. But... that's always a good sign. You know, when you feel the weight of it, then that means, yeah, I got to do it because that's a challenge. I love challenges. That's why I do this music. If I don't challenge myself, nothing new will happen.
Right. And you're a hack.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be a hack.
I could go on all day. This has been great. Cassandra Wilson, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. What fun.
Coming Forth by Day, Cassandra Wilson's tribute to Billie Holiday, comes out next month. But you can hear a track now from the album at our website, studio360.org.
I love my band. I'm alive if I say I don't.
a man. I'm a liar if I say I don't. But I quit my man. I'm a liar if I say I won't.
Cassandra Wilson has recorded a couple of dozen albums, which is nothing compared to Mingering Mike, who racked up 150 records in less than 10 years. But you can't listen to any of his. That amazing true story up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. In his day job, Dori Hedar works as a criminal investigator in Washington, D.C., but he is also a music nut and moonlights as a DJ, so he's always on the lookout for obscure records. One night, about a decade ago, he got off work around 5 a.m. And, like the vinyl record fanatic he is, he went straight to his favorite flea market, which was just opening up.
And there were about 2,000 records, so I had first crack at them, and I found all kinds of great stuff. It was in the last box of records that I found something truly bizarre, about 40 hand-painted and seemingly imaginary soul albums.
Imaginary, because when Dori looked inside the cardboard sleeves, instead of LPs, all he found was more cardboard, cut into perfect 12-inch circles.
And they were so detailed, with the grooves painted onto them, with labels pasted on. My mind was blown. I had never seen anything quite like this. They had titles like Boogie Down to the White House, You Know Only What They Tell You, the soundtrack to The Sexorcist.
Dori was stumped, but deeply intrigued. And so he put his professional detective skills to work.
This guy who made these albums, he called himself Mingering Mike. I think I definitely would have heard of someone named Mingering Mike if he really existed.
Hello, my name is Mingering Mike.
My friend Frank and I, we were out on this mission to find Mingering Mike, and when we finally determined what his real address was, we knocked on the door.
Who is it?
And this man peeked out very suspiciously.
When he came to the door, I thought he was a bill collector.
I can't say I blame him, these two random white guys showing up at your doorstep. But his eyes lit up at the mention of the album.
I said, oh, my babies. You got my babies? So then he said, yeah. And we kind of laughed.
You know, what's funny is there are so many self-portraits on these album covers. And they all really look like him. He's got a very boyish face. You know, when he opened the door, we could immediately tell it was him.
I started drawing, I believe, I probably was about 8 or 9. So when I was in the Cub Scouts, they wanted me to draw the pictures of the presidents. So then I started designing the 45s and album covers.
You know, he even created call numbers for each record. He even made the songs on the records correlate to the actual lengths of the songs.
Yeah, because when I started doing the albums, I wanted them to be like actual albums that people could look at and enjoy.
You know, as a kid, I think he was a little bit of a loner. So I get the sense that he didn't leave the house all that much and that he really was just completely devoted to this imaginary career. 'Cause I'm the kind of guy
that's really, really shy. That's all I thought about. At one time, I think I wrote like 6 songs in one day. The album art was really like the second stage, because the first stage was the development of these songs. Like, I would come home from work and I would have all the albums up on the wall. And it astonished me sometimes because I'm in another world, like when you're out there working and then you come home and it's like your little kingdom. And I said, what? I said, oh, I did that.
A lot of Mike's albums and song titles really are reminiscent of, you know, some of the big soul musicians at the time, James Brown, Curtis Mayfield, a lot of the Motown acts. They could have come right off one of their albums.
at the time with the boogie down at the White House, I just thought, I said, what if Nixon was the boogie? What if he was to get down and would people, you know, accept him more if he was funky? Peepa, peepa. I think I would. It was a fantasy world, and I wanted to be ready just in case it became reality.
While Mike took this all really seriously, I think he played around with it quite a bit. On one of his albums, there's this fantastic portrait of Mike. He's just beaming. And underneath, there's a quote from James Brown that says, "With a look of success, singing and dancing, boy, he's a mess."
Nobody loves me but my mama, and she could be jiving me, too.
Tell him, Godfather.
God, I mean, you just want it to be real, you know? And you can imagine when I pulled this out of the box at the flea market, it was like, oh, oh man, you know, why is this made of cardboard? You know, during the period that he made these albums, there was so much for him to reflect upon. And so in that respect, these albums make up a diary. I mean, they are essentially a diary. The ones that really stand out to me are the ones that have to do with the war and his struggle of being drafted and ultimately deciding to go AWOL.
There was no way of getting out of it, so I had to go. And my assigned place at the time was Cambodia. So the next step after Cambodia would be Vietnam. So I said, I think I'll just go out the back door. You know, whatever decision you make at that time, right or wrong, you still got to live it through.
He actually created a record label called Decision Records, and he had albums such as The Two Sides of Mingering Mike, which on the front cover it shows two portraits of Mingering Mike facing in opposite directions, and one of them is him holding a machine gun, and the opposite portrait is him singing into a microphone.
And it's like, what decision would you make?
Who am I?
He actually made original a cappella recordings. One of his most heartfelt songs is called But All I Can Do Is Cry, which he basically wrote the night before he was to report for duty.
And with the acoustics in the bathroom and everything, everyone sounds like a fantastic singer to themselves. So then I just got me a little 3-inch reel-to-reel recorder and started recording.
You can hear the hurt in his voice and maybe even him crying on that recording.
The words just started coming through automatically. I did not know exactly what I was going to say, but you know, it turned out with never thought I could stoop so low and stand so tall and to cry. But all I can do is cry. And went on from there.
I don't really like to classify Mike as any particular sort of artist. You know, the term outsider artist gives the impression that someone, you know, might not be all there. And it's just not the case. He's an ordinary guy. He's kind and sweet. And, you know, he just had an amazing, amazing imagination.
Each day through my window, I watch her as she passes by. I say to myself, you're such a lucky guy.
Dori Hadara is the author of a book about Mingering Mike. And right now, the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington has an exhibit called Mingering Mike's Supersonic Greatest Hits. You can see some of those album covers at our website, studio360.org. WBEZ's Derek John produced our story.
Just my imagination running away with me.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next week. And come visit us anytime you like on Facebook. We are there and posting great stuff constantly, so come say hi. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Tal Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasha Pula,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegel.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch is the original transgender tragicomic rock opera.
My sex change operation got botched. My guardian angel fell asleep on the watch. Now all I've got is a Barbie doll crotch. I've got an angry inch.
It's author and star John Cameron Mitchell next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.